From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made with you, or maybe someone you know. According to federal data, 1 in 7 Americans will develop a substance use disorder at some point in their lives. And 1 in 5 U.S. adults experience mental illness each year. Perhaps there are people in your life struggling with these issues who aren't vocal about them because they're afraid of stigma that is often tied to them. And perhaps you've seen public figures navigate these issues with varying degrees of openness. Matthew Perry's story has become top of mind for people who want to combat the stigma that I've mentioned. And one person who's been very open about their advocacy for attention to these issues is Chaz Bono. You may know him for his work on American Horror Story, Curb Your Enthusiasm, for his Emmy-nominated documentary, Becoming Chaz, or from his work as an LGBTQ plus rights advocate. What you may not know is that for more than 2 decades now, Bono has celebrated his sobriety. He struggled with substance use disorder in his past. This hour, Bono joins us on Connections to share his story. It's a preview of his upcoming keynote lecture for the annual Hope and Recovery Celebration for East House. We talked to him about living in recovery, the stigma he's dealt with at times, both in his personal life and in the public eye, and how to help other people who are working through these same challenges. And I'd like to welcome my guest for this first half hour of the program, Chaz Bono. Hey, Chaz, thank you for making time for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Chaz is generous with his time today. After we let Chaz go, we're going to talk with a couple local guests who are in our studio. I'll say hello now. Jamie Caminali is Chief Program Officer for East House.
Hello.
Welcome back here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And welcome as well to Moira Strauss, East House alumnus living in recovery. How are you doing? Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get back to Chaz, I just want to say to Jamie, you know, you always bring such interesting people who have these powerful stories to share here. And what do you want to let people know if they haven't decided yet? There's still tickets available for the event that is coming up next Thursday. That's a week from today, in fact.
That is a week from today, September 19th. It's at the Harrow East Ballroom, and you can visit our website, easthouse.org, for tickets.
Easthouse.org, tickets there. How important is this event to you?
It's extremely important to just get the information out there, let people know what we're about, and let people know what recovery is about.
And I know that there are listeners who hear East House and they don't right away know exactly what the mission is. Why don't you describe it?
Our mission is to serve individuals in recovery from mental illness and substance use disorders, to empower them to lead fulfilling lives and give them a warm place to land so that they can be, you know, by their own definition, successful.
I know the demand for these services in this country has grown a lot, especially in the last decade. But it's a lot of resources to have to do it well. Are you growing?
We are growing. The organization is really focused and driven to make sure that we have enough programs and availability for individuals seeking services. We have grown, you know, multiple beds in our organization within the last year, and we continue to grow and look for more opportunities.
Well, we're going to get back to our guests in studio after we talk to Chaz Bono. But Chaz, I just want to say, first of all, thank you for being generous with your time. And, you know, I know you talk to organizations around the country. How much have you gotten to know about East House so far?
From everything that I've known about it and read up on, it just seems to be a great organization, which is why I'm taking part in this event and excited to do so.
When it comes to your own story, like I mentioned, I think people know you for a lot of different reasons, but the hope and recovery part may not be at the top of the list. Can you describe a little bit about what you have been through and some of the themes that you're going to bring to East House?
Sure. I have to go back a ways. In 1995, I had a girlfriend who passed away from cancer, and that was just obviously devastating and something that was incredibly difficult to deal with, especially, you know, in my mid to early 20s. And at the same time, I had a chronic pain issue that started. And for me, that was really kind of the perfect storm that got me addicted to prescription opiate medications.
How long did that last? And can you tell us a little bit about, you know, maybe if there were times where you were aware of it and trying to work through it, or did it take you a while to realize it was a problem?
So, yeah, I mean, at first I didn't think it was a problem. You know, I was taking medication prescribed to me for legitimate reasons, and I really, you know, didn't think it was a problem. And it also, for me, I mean, it's a progressive, you know, disease. And, you know, so for me, for several years, I mean, I was very, you know, I was high functioning. I wasn't, you know, using every day. But as what kind of inevitably happens with substance abuse is that it got to be more and more of an issue and to hinder my life more and more. So the other thing that I'll say is that I was in so much emotional pain at that point in my life that I honestly thought that, you know, life was the problem. I would have said at that point that, you know, my motto is kind of life equals pain. And so I honestly believe that life was the problem and that these, you know, medications were the only thing keeping me going. And it, you know, so I abused substances for probably about 8 to 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
I finally got the help that I needed, went to a treatment center, and spent a month there, and then, you know, came home and started going to 12-step meetings and did some outpatient work. And, you know, thank God I haven't had to really deal with, you know, a relapse or anything after that. And, I've been sober now for 20 years. And I'm, you know, just so grateful, because the time in my life when I wasn't was just, you know, got more and more miserable.
Does growing up in sort of a famous household and then, you know, living a life as a person with a lot of fame yourself, does that make it harder to deal with what can be very personal issues like this? Or are there any advantages that come with that? I mean, how did that affect you?
I don't think there are any advantages that come to it. You know, it can be more difficult. I've, you know, had paparazzis outside of meetings. Mm-hmm. And I have to be, you know, when I share at meetings, I have to do it in a slightly more general way than I think most people can, just because, you know, who I am and who my family is. And so that's probably the main differences I've found. Otherwise, I mean, being famous is certainly no excuse to not get into recovery.
Sure.
Coming from a famous family.
No, I mean, I take the point. And, you know, some of your fans probably know that, you know, of course they know your parents, and they a lot know that it hasn't always been easy with both your parents. They've been very different relationships, different people.
Yes.
And I wonder if part of when you went through those 8-9 years of substance use disorder, if you got tighter, if you drifted away from family, how did family come into play for you?
I drifted away from everyone, you know, eventually. I mean, my life just got smaller and smaller and smaller. I will say that the one person who didn't believe my lies was my mom. And, you know, and she had confronted me a few times and I denied it. And then when I finally hit my bottom, you know, she was the first person I called, and I was like, I need help. You know, I need some help. I need, you know, can you help me go to rehab? And and of course, she was just really thrilled to, you know, that I was finally wanting to address it.
Can you describe for listeners who are working through either their own substance use disorder or someone that they know, someone that they love who is working through it, can you describe what it was like for you when you had that moment with your mother that allowed you to be, I don't know, again, what your years of kind of working through were like, but like, to be honest, to put it out there, to not run from it and to try to address it.
Yeah, so I'll tell you kind of what happened to me. You know, I didn't have like this dramatic bottom where, like, you know, I almost died or I almost killed somebody or anything like that. I was in therapy, and my therapist knew what was going on, and I had been kind of, you know, it wasn't even a half measure. I mean, I was supposed to be trying to cut down, but it, you know, I really wasn't that to that degree. And I went in for a session, and I was finally honest about where I was at and what I wanted, which was to be left alone to do drugs. And for some reason, when I articulated that out loud to somebody, you know, just being completely honest about it, I realized at that moment, oh my God, I need help. Like, I am in trouble. And so, you know, that moment then kind of allowed, then I was trying to, you know, it took me maybe 2 weeks or whatever to figure out, you know, what route I was going to take. And I realized that I couldn't even imagine being in my house and not being, you know, not abusing the substance. So I decided that I needed to get out and get to, you know, get help someplace else. Like I said, and then that's when I talked to my mom, and my mom had been, you know, very concerned about me for a while. And, you know, and it was just great to have, you know, my mom, you know, has a good understanding of this disease, and, you know, was just right there to help right away, which was amazing.
Obviously, most of us will never have the experience of having, you know, a mother that a lot of the world knows, but knows through their work and through their celebrity, as opposed to as a parent. What can you tell us about your mother as a parent? Most of us experience her for her, obviously, for her work.
Yeah. You know, my mom, she's a good parent. I mean, she's always done the best she could. She's, you know, she was essentially a single mother raising us. And so she, you know, she was away a lot and worked a lot, but, you know, I know that was hard for her. And she, you know, I think she really did the best that she could. And now as adults, you know, we have a really great relationship. You know, she's amazing. I'm incredibly proud of her achievements, and we, you know, we have a good time together.
Talking to Chaz Bono, who is coming to Rochester and going to be a big part of the event 1 week from today, the 2024 Hope and Recovery Celebration. It's a conversation with Chaz Bono happening next Thursday, September 19th, starting at noon at the Harrow East Ballroom. Tickets are still available, and they would love to see you there, easthouse.org. We can surmise as to the reason for this, but I would love to hear you talk a little bit, Chaz, about the fact that the LGBTQ plus community has higher rates of substance disorder or substance misuse than those who identify as heterosexual. What do you make of that?
I mean, I think it's pretty, you know, I don't say it's because it's harder to be somebody in the LGBTQ plus community. You're you know, you're constantly being attacked or ridiculed or made to feel less than. You're dealing with the stress of you know, having to come out to people, not knowing what they're going to think. For me, one of the toughest times that I had was when I, figured out that I was trans, which took a really long time, and then trying to actually do something about it, which was almost a decade started before I was in recovery, and then I was still struggling it for 5 years in sobriety. So, you know, the pressure on you is tremendous. And so, the desire to relieve that stress, to, you know, check out for a little while is very appealing.
Well, before I let you go, let me just ask you about how you see the conversation in Hollywood, or maybe even how these issues are displayed on screen. What have you noticed a lot of change over the years on this issue?
There are films out there that are, you know, that are great that deal with this, with substance abuse and going through recovery well. I can think of movies. They're probably from a while ago, but like, you know, When a Man Loves a Woman, 28 Days. When I was in treatment, we had, we'd have a movie night, but it had to be, you know, a movie about recovery. And again, there's a lot of good stuff. And I think people are, you know, starting to, more and more understand that, substance abuse is, it's not weak, doesn't mean you're a weak person, doesn't mean you're a bad person. It means that you have a disease that basically, you know, whose desire is to slowly kill you with substances. I would say that, you know, there's really good stuff out there for people to see if they're interested in those type of films.
What are you working on next these days?
So I have a movie that I'm in and produced, opening in theaters on October 4th. I'm actually going right from this event to Austin, Texas for a big film festival that we're in there, where it's going to be our United States premiere, called Fantastic Fest. And the movie's called Little Bites. It's a horror film. It's an amazing kind of, you know, deep horror film. And I would really, you know, just anybody who's a fan of the genre, I would recommend it wholeheartedly. I hope you go and see it.
And certainly some fans of Curb Your Enthusiasm, cheered your appearance on that show. That show, you know, they push envelopes. They have some fun. What was the experience like there? Without giving away too much about what the episode was about, for example.
I would say, there were little stressful moments, but, you know, just because of the nature of the subject and wanting to really get it right. But it was just a great experience. Those guys are so nice over there. They treated me great. I had never, you know, done, anything that was like purely improv the way that show is. and you know, just I had a great time doing it. I loved working with Larry. He was hysterical. I mean, it was a really good experience.
Is there less of a script on the show and a little bit more of an opportunity to sort of flow?
So it's basically it's a breakdown of scenes, but there are no lines.
That's so interesting. Probably a great amount of fun.
Yeah, no, it was. I mean, I hadn't done anything, you know, quite like that, and I'd come, you know, off of American Horror Story, and so it was fun to do, you know, some comedy, and yeah, I had a really great time. It was just a great set to work on. The people, you know, there are you know, top notch and really nice and welcoming. So it was great.
For a number of reasons, I'm not going to give away too much what Chaz's appearance is about in Curb Your Enthusiasm if you didn't see it in the series that wrapped recently, but you can go find Chaz's work there, easy to find. And lastly, before I let you go, Chaz, you know, I mean, it's 2024, and we have seen an evolution as well in streaming shows, in movies, about how trans issues are depicted. There's a movie coming out at the end of this month called Will and Harper. It's a real life documentary about Will Ferrell and his apparently his lifelong best friend, who was a former SNL head writer who he met when he was on SNL. Came out as trans, and Will and him Will and Harper, they travel the country and they are experiencing what it is like. So Will can understand it and understand his friend who he loves. And I wonder if you've been aware of this movie and if you have hopes for films like this.
I mean, I wasn't aware of this movie, but it sounds amazing and I'll definitely check it out. Yeah. I mean, I think Hollywood is starting to get, you know, much better with the depiction of trans characters and you know, are casting more trans actors. I would say that I hope we could get to a point where Hollywood only looks at trans actors for trans parts. But you know, I feel like we're going in the right direction as far as depictions go.
Well, I want to thank you for making the time for our program today, and I want to remind listeners that they can have a chance to hear Chaz Bono in person. Chaz will be here 1 week from today for the 2024 Hope and Recovery Celebration. It's a conversation with Chaz Bono. He will be here on Thursday, September 19th, starting at noon. The event is at the Harrow East Ballroom. And full disclosure, WXXI is a proud media sponsor. Tickets are still available. You can get them at easthouse.org. Chaz, good luck to you. Thanks for making time for us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That's Chaz Bono. After we take this only break of the hour, we're going to come back and we're going to talk to our guests in studio about some of the themes we heard there. We're going to talk about some of the work that East House is doing. And I think a personal story that you ought to hear on the other side of this, our only break of the hour. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, my colleague Sarah Abamonte hosts two conversations related to disabilities. In the first hour, research shows people with disabilities are 14% more likely to experience difficulty with voting. Monroe County Elections Commissioners talk about what they're doing about that. In our second hour, direct support professionals help people with disabilities so they can live independently. But the field is experiencing changes, and we'll explore it. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So Jamie Caminali, who's the Chief Program Officer for East House, just heard Chaz Bono on the program here. What do you make of some of what you heard there?
I mean, it all makes sense, and it's everything that we already know here in our own community. A lot of what Chaz talked about, you know, I think we have individuals that we serve today, both at East House and outside of East House, that have similar stories.
How do most people you serve end up with you at East House?
Yep. So most individuals come through us through referral pathways, right? So they have to engage with a provider, whether it's a doctor or outpatient therapist. And we do have people who know people who've been in our program and say, hey, I know where you need to go. And so it's really, it can be organic, but it also can be really, it can be a professional-based referral as well.
Well, Moira Strauss is with us, an East House alumnus living in recovery. And you said you're doing pretty well these days, yeah?
I am. I'm doing fabulously.
Can you take some time to tell us the story of how you ended up in with East House?
Certainly. I am a fifth child of a Roman Catholic Irish family. Grew up in a very stable environment, never worried about dinner on the table. I was unfortunately molested as a child, which did deeply impact my mental health going forward. But very supportive family, loving family. I went to college. I got married. I bought a house, had the toys, everything, but was slowly becoming a worse and worse alcoholic. And my husband was an alcoholic and ended up losing all of those things. The marriage went away, the house went away, the job went away, but still didn't identify it, or chose not to identify it as my addiction. And particularly going back into a restaurant job that kind of doesn't really encourage sobriety. So I flailed along that way, and it just reached a point where I was losing those jobs. And as Chaz said, my circle became smaller and smaller. And I knew that there was a problem. And I had entered an outpatient treatment group and had been unable to stay sober through that, and had been recommended to go to an inpatient facility. In the meantime, I got a DWI, and I wasn't able to get to the court appearance. So long and short, there was a arrest warrant, and I ended up in jail. And I felt in jail, I distinctly remember feeling a tremendous sense of relief when I was in jail those first couple of days.
Relief.
It was a terrifying experience, but I felt a tremendous sense of relief because I couldn't drink even if I wanted to. It was just completely taken away from me because the desire to drink, the need to drink, was that strong. And so from jail, I went bed to bed to Norris Clinic, and that's where I engaged with East House. And they were, I will always remember this wonderful woman who I met with, and she was lovely, and she was non-judgmental, and she listened to me cry, and she let me cry, and she was, again, just not judgmental and open to my experience. And that's how I began my journey with East House. So I left Norris Clinic, and by my own request, I stayed there extended until a bed was open with Penny Cook, the halfway house that I went to, because I didn't want to have that experience of being out in the community when my sobriety was not fully in place. And so Norris was great that way, that I was able to stay there and ended up being, I think, about 8 weeks, and went to Penny Cook House. And Penny Cook House was wonderful. It's a beautiful home in a lovely neighborhood. It's also in a neighborhood that I used to drink and drug in. So that was great, I thought, because if I was going to be tempted, let it be kind of on my own neighborhood. And I said I needed to be told by a 22-year-old to go sweep the floor. You know, I was in my late 40s then. I needed to relearn how to be a functioning member of society. I needed all that time at Norris and in jail to just let my brain kind of empty of the alcohol, truly. And Penny Cook was the start of the rebuilding phase for me. And then from there, I went to what's called supportive living. I was in, this is also with East House, I was in an apartment with a roommate with restrictions or conditions, I should say. And a big thing I found with East House is East House furnishes those apartments. And when I went on to independent living, where I was in my own apartment with my own lease, but East House funded it, they furnish it from top to bottom. And it's done very nicely. And it's hard to explain, but as someone in early recovery, to be given a nice couch and a bath mat and clean sheets and curtains is a huge way that they told me I was worth something. I was worth this investment. So to have the Housing First model, to have a safe place that I knew I could come home to every day, that I wanted to go home to every day, was a tremendous weight off of my early sobriety. So I went back to school, and I got in with Access VR, a government organization that funded my education. So I went back to school at MCC, transferred to Upstate Medical, and graduated with a degree in respiratory care. So I am now a respiratory therapist at Highland Hospital.
How long have you been a respiratory therapist now?
I'm almost a year active in my job.
Amazing.
Yes. Yes. Incredible gratitude. Incredible gratitude to everyone, to East House, to my early AA groups, to my family, who I had become distanced from as well, and who now are fully involved in my life, and I'm in theirs. They will all be at the luncheon. My sister's flying in from Philadelphia. My brother and my other brother's wife is attending.
Oh, Moira.
Yes, I'm very fortunate.
What a story.
And very grateful.
Let me go back and ask a little bit more about how this kind of unfolded. And then I want to talk about how you see your future.
Mm-hmm.
When you started drinking, how young were you when you started drinking?
I'm sure I had my first sip of alcohol very young. My parents were not heavy drinkers, but there was rampant alcoholism through particularly my mother's side of the family. So I'm sure at some Thanksgiving or something, I was sipping on something.
And what were you, when you were really drinking, starting to drink heavily,
mm-hmm.
what were you drinking?
At the very end, I would drink almost a bottle of vodka a day. If I could
Straight vodka?
Straight vodka. Cheapest I could get. Warm out of the bottle if it was.
Yeah.
You know, there was one of my last jobs, I remember getting my paycheck, catching it, going to the liquor store, and pouring a shot into like this broken styrofoam cup that I had so I could discreetly take a shot while I was driving away because I needed it. Because
while you were driving?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And at the end, my hands shook. I couldn't sign a check. I was starting to gag when I brushed my teeth. I mean, I had to drink in the morning in order to kill the shakes to be able to go to work.
You said that you lost your marriage, your house, your job
because
of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how quickly all of that happened, but when that was happening, are you thinking to yourself, it's because of the alcohol I have a problem? Or
no.
What was going through your mind?
No. As an alcoholic, I think we all have a tremendous ability to deny and to deflect. So, you know, the marriage was, well, you know, any marriage issues that you can pin. The house was, well, you know, I haven't been working consistently, so I haven't been able to maintain things. And the job I was let go for a different reason, but it all connected to the alcohol. So I was always able to pin it on something else. And denial is tremendous in alcoholism until you are ready to surrender.
And it was the arrest. Or were you ready before then?
I was ready. I was waiting to get into an inpatient program. I was ready, but was unable to stop. Was physically, and that's, I think, what is hard for people who are not alcoholics to understand. I was physically unable to stop. So, and that's why I say there was that sense of relief when I got to jail, because I couldn't drink even if I wanted to.
Did you have withdrawal in jail?
I didn't have seizures. I was having withdrawals, and it was not for a few days until a social worker actually had a conversation with me, and she said, well, you should be on medication to prevent seizures. So I didn't have a seizure, but I did definitely have withdrawals, yes.
And yet, in your mind, it's almost like, I've got to go through this. Like, this has to happen.
Oh, I welcomed it because, it was such a sense of relief because I just knew that was the day, the first day in jail was the day that my 100% commitment to my sobriety and to my journey began.
You're this remarkable person who's successful. You have a direction in your life. You're helping people. But you had lost so much. Mm-hmm. And it could have been a time for you to sort of become nihilistic or give up and think that, you know, nothing matters. You could think about what you've lost. Why do you think that you were so determined to change all of that when you had lost so much?
Well, I think because I came from a strong family, and my sister had always been there in the background of my addiction. If I, you know, I reached out to her when I lost the last apartment and I was waiting to get into rehab, I would have been homeless. And I knew I was going to be able to go in within a week. And I contacted my sister and she said, prove to me that you're going to that you're on this waiting list. Prove it to me and I'll pay for a motel for you.
Reasonable question.
Absolutely. And yeah. And when I went to jail, my sister contacted the judge and she said, do not let her out under any circumstance until she goes to rehab. She's a menace to herself and to society. She contacted him directly.
And how do you feel about her doing that?
I support it fully. She helped.
She loves you.
She loves me. Absolutely. Yeah. She loves me. And that was done out of love. And that was the tough love that had my mother still been alive, my mother had somewhat enabled and only out of love, only out of love. But my sister is a psychotherapist. So she understood that tough love was necessary here.
You still get on with your sister?
Oh, yeah. She'll be there Thursday.
Okay. Well, I think this part of the conversation is really important because what you're describing, Moira, is so delicate for so many families. Do I say something? Do I confront somebody? Do we try to have an intervention? What do we think will work? I am very, very bad at this. I am always convinced that what I will do will make something worse or make somebody shut down. And I probably have some fear, some cowardice that comes in. And I know that every person is different. Not every family intervention or family interaction will result in the same thing. But can you describe the importance of what you think family can do or should do when someone isn't seeing it, isn't seeing their own substance use disorder?
Well, I think I'll only speak for myself, but a direct confrontation doesn't always work. That can be detrimental because if you're not ready to get sober, then for me, it would have just said, you know, leave me alone, you're wrong. And it would have thrown me worse into the bottle because I don't want to admit it or accept it or believe it, right? I know in the back of my mind I am. I would think that a conversation of, hey, I've seen you're drinking a lot. It concerns me. And if there's anything I can do to help, I am here. And that's what I tell people that I've been involved with in the recovery community who go back out. I'm here for you when you're ready. When you're ready, I'm here for you. Direct confrontation for someone who's not ready, can just push them further away. It may work for some people, but I think it's kind of tough because some of the cliche statements, until you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, it's such a true statement. So until I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, nothing anyone said to me was going to do anything.
Your sister's decision to intervene the way she did once you were arrested, though, that was an example of tough love.
Absolutely.
That measures that had to be taken.
Yes. I there's a difference between tough love and direct confrontation. So tough love is absolutely a great way. But direct confrontation, hey, Moira, I think you're an alcoholic. I think you need help. In a confrontational tone would have set me back.
Would it have helped? Did anybody tell you, like, I'm not going to get in the car when you're driving? I'd be worried about kids being in a car with you. Like, did those conversations ever happen? And would that have helped?
No, because at that point I had drifted from my family. And again, as Chaz mentioned, your circle gets smaller and smaller. So I associated with people who, didn't judge because they were excessive drinkers or druggers themselves. Mm-hmm. So your circle becomes smaller and smaller into people who don't judge you because they're doing it themselves.
Did you have any, Chaz talked about relapse. Chaz has not dealt with relapse. I mean, everyone's different. How have you done with that?
I have had a couple of relapses over my sobriety journey. And both times I can look at it as things were too good. When I was so comfortable in hating myself, tremendous shame and self-disgust, tremendous levels. And then things are good. Things are stable. I'm doing well. That's very uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable. Because I'm not used to that. I'm used to being disassociated by my family. I'm used to being Moyer the drunk. I'm used to failing and not being able to be stable. And so when that is all there, I became very uncomfortable. I through tremendous therapy, I've realized this looking back, right? At the moment, to the buildup, you know, the job for me now is to recognize these signs as they're building, right? But back then, when that was building up, I didn't recognize it. And it became very scary to me. I realized that things were well.
Wow. Such an interesting insight into how it affects you. Mm-hmm. But these days you're doing great. We're going to talk more about what the future looks like. Jamie, what do you make of this story here?
Well, I've known the story. it's been amazing to watch Moira. It was good to catch up with her. But I think that Moira tells a story, like I said, Chaz did, that most people can say, yep, I understand. I hear where you are. And it does sometimes take that massive intervention, whether it's legal, whether it's physical health issues, whether it's family, loss of family. People might refer to it as a rock bottom that makes people wake up and realize that they want something different. So I love listening to her story because I think that Moira, she lives and breathes it every day. And it's relatable and it reduces the stigma around it because if you met Moira, you would never know her story unless she shared it with you. You know, you would have no idea. And I think people need to recognize that people we eat, play, and live among every day have similar stories.
Moira, do you think now that you would be capable of just socially drinking?
No.
Can't do it?
No, absolutely not.
And if you were drinking straight vodka by the end of your time of really hardcore alcoholism, if a friend said to you, hey, just have a beer, just have a glass of wine. It's not vodka. Just have one. Mm-hmm. That's not something that you can entertain, right?
No, absolutely not. And that would be a person that I would need to let go of as well. Because anyone who is a friend of mine would never do something like that. So that would be something that I would disassociate with the person as well.
What would you say to family and friends who have had someone go through maybe a similar process that you've had, but the person who is in your shoes is saying, no, I feel like I can socially drink. I can feel like it's not the same. Like, I'm good. I know every person is different, and I don't want you to make a sweeping judgment on every human being who's ever dealt with substance abuse disorder. But for the family or friends who are thinking, you know, I'm not comfortable with this. I'm worried. Can I bring it up? How do I bring it up? Should they bring it up?
Yes, I think it's absolutely appropriate to bring it up. I just think tone is a very big factor in that.
Loving tone?
For me, loving tone, again, I can't speak for everyone, but for me, just a tone of I'm witnessing this, I'm concerned, I'm here for you. If you say, you know, you're drinking way too much, it's a problem, you're an alcoholic, you need to get help, that can, excuse me, let's say, you know, F you or you know, forgive me, but you know.
You get a little defensive.
Yeah, absolutely, because I'm already denying it to myself, so how dare you judge me when I'm already trying not to admit it to myself.
Okay. Now that you've got work, you've got this career, what do you want to do next? Tell me about what the next 5 to 10 years looks like for you.
I'm already starting to do it. I'm so incredibly grateful. I'm going to Iceland in a few months on a trip. I have an emergency fund already made. I have investments starting. The student loan is being paid off. So it's all of that stability of, you know, I'm 54 years old. So restarting my life at this age is, there's a little pressure to get to prepare for the future. So I'd like to progress in my career. I'd like to travel. I'd like to spend more time with family and build for a stable retirement.
That's great.
And of course, continue with my work. I've worked for over 10 years with, or excuse me, over 5 years with what is now the People's Pantry. It began as the Southwich Food Program, and I also used to volunteer at Asbury Soup Kitchen. So that type of work is very important to me as well. It's not direct giving back to the recovery community, but it's giving back to people that struggle. Right. And so it's very, very important to me.
Why Iceland?
Actually, a deal came up online.
That's pretty great.
But it was a fantastic deal.
I don't know anybody who's ever been to Reykjavik and was like, yeah, everybody loves it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just thought, you know, can I justify spending $1,000 doing this? And I said, you know, again, I'm 54. I'm banking money for retirement, but I also need to live. So.
It strikes me as the kind of thing where you're going to take that trip and you're going to think at some point in your life when things were at their worst, you couldn't imagine
exactly
traveling,
yes,
getting on a plane,
yep,
going on a vacation like this.
Yep.
So representative of what you have achieved.
Yes.
So,
I just got back from 10 days in the Adirondacks with family and my dog, and I had many moments of this is what sobriety has given me.
Before I close the hour here, I want to ask you, Moira, if you have any, maybe resentment might be the word. So I think about myself. There is some alcoholism in my family. I like to have a glass of wine or a cocktail. I've never felt like I have to. I go many days without drinking, then I might want a drink or two. Like, it just doesn't affect me physically. Mm-hmm. It's something that I like to do on the side, but it is not something that I feel fortunate that I don't feel like it can get out of control. And I think that sometimes people who, for lack of a better term, are not predisposed to alcoholism, perhaps, may have a moral judgment against people who struggle with it. And do you feel resentment, you know, in that way, thinking like, why me? Like, why did this have to hit me this way? Why am I not able to feel like I can have a social drink and without losing control? Do you have that sense of resentment?
I don't. I'm sure at one point I did. Now it's kind of a joke amongst people when I see someone at a restaurant and they finish a half a glass of wine and leave it to go sit at their table. And I think, who's that crazy person who didn't finish that glass of wine? So I can
mostly, I think it's a bad investment. It's expensive.
Right. But I can laugh about it now most of the time, I think. Alcohol never ended well for me. So I don't have a concept of what it would be like.
What would you say to people who don't struggle the way you have, but maybe have made those moral judgments about people who struggle with alcoholism?
To try and educate themselves a little more and to look around their families, as you said. You know, if you look around your family and friend group, there's been someone who has struggled, who has gotten sober. It's there's just no question. So educate yourself a little bit and speak to the person that's in recovery. You know, I know anyone who wants to speak to me, I will. It's not, and believe me, being here today is not something I want to do. I absolutely don't want to be here. Laying myself open to a network of people is not comfortable. It's not fun. But it's, to me, it's necessary. And it's a way that I can give back some of what's been given to me.
We're so grateful that you're willing to do it. Because there's no question you're connecting to people who need to hear it. I got about 90 seconds left. Jamie Cominale, who is the Chief Program Officer for East House, floor is yours. What do you want to leave with listeners today?
You know, I think you guys touched on a couple of things is making sure that if you're a loved one of someone that you're not ignoring the issue. And there's plenty of support groups out there for folks to reach out to if they don't have the tools like Al-Anon and Nar-Anon. And you just go to their websites and they have plenty of meetings throughout Monroe County. And, you know, I just want to make sure people are aware that if you go to easthouse.org, all of our services are also outlined there and resources that go well beyond just our organization to make sure that folks are connected, including tickets for our Hope and Recovery Luncheon next Thursday, September 19th at the Harrow East Ballroom at 12 p.m.
They would love to see you there. This is a very important event for East House on an annual basis. Chaz Bono, who joined us in our first half hour, will be there. Chaz is telling his story and having a conversation. And Moira is going to be there.
Yes.
Some of Moira's family is going to be there.
Yes.
It's going to be an important day. It's going to be a great day because the work that they do is so important in this community. And Moira, I'm amazed at how comfortable, I mean, maybe you're not all that comfortable inside, but your facility in telling this story is really impressive. I talk to a lot of people, 500 hours a year, and you are at the top of the list of people who are able to tell hard stories and impact people. Thank you for doing it.
Thank you.
Moira Strauss, who is an East House alumnus living in recovery, has a great career, going to Iceland. It's good stuff. A lot of great stuff happening. Jamie Cominale, Chief Program Officer for East House, easthouse.org. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
And good luck with the event. It is next Thursday at noon. You got a hall pass from Connections to miss us live that day if you got to be there at East House next Thursday at noon for their Hope and Recovery celebration. From the whole team at Connections, thank you for listening. And we are back with you Friday on member-supported public radio.